Yes, friends, it's time for Let's Talk Mental Health. This local program discusses behavioral issues of concern to the North Shore community and resources to help. Let's Talk Mental Health is produced at the studios of KTWHLP in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Good day to our listeners and welcome to this month's edition of Let's Talk Mental Health. This month continues a series where we are highlighting local mental health resources. Today, we are highlighting Kalina Counseling Services located here in Two Harbors, and we are going to be speaking with Madison Witchen. She is a mental health therapist, she has an MA, and she's licensed as an LADC. Madison grew up on the Iron Range in northern Minnesota. As a young adult, Madison quickly began to notice the lack of mental health services available in the rural towns of Minnesota. She moved to the Twin Cities to attend college at St. Catharines University and completed her Bachelor of Arts in Psychology. Here, she recognized what it looked like to have mental health services readily available, began to wonder how she could make a difference in the small rural community that she loved so much. Madison attended graduate school at Hazelden Betty Ford Graduate School of Addiction Studies, completing the Advanced Practice Program. Here, she focused on addiction and the impacts it can have on mental health. Madison is a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, LADC, and is working towards licensure to become a licensed professional clinical counselor, which is an LPCC. She has worked with adolescents and adults diagnosed with addiction and co-occurring mental health disorders. Additionally, she has experience working with returning citizens involved in the criminal justice system. Madison utilizes a person-centered, strength-based approach. She feels the most important part of her job is to build a strong therapeutic alliance with her clients, foster an environment for growth, and collaborate to help individuals achieve their goals. In her free time, Madison enjoys spending time outdoors. She loves to go fishing, camping, and hiking with her family, which includes her two four-legged companions. She's very excited to be back on the Iron Range area, working to achieve her goals through offering hope and strength to truly make a difference. Madison, good day, and how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. We want to thank you very much for being with us today. It's a fascinating topic to talk about, not only mental health, but mental health resources within the local area. And you are one of those professionals that are providing those services. Can you tell us a little bit more about your personal and professional experience with mental health services as a practitioner?
I started kind of some of my experience working in the mental health field through internships while I was attending Hazelden's grad school. During those internships, what I had completed was a IOP Core 12 program, which was a men's outpatient program for substance use. And I did this through Hazelden Betty Ford in the St. Paul facility. And there we focused on working with men who actually specifically had opioid-related substance use disorders. I did my first internship there, and then I spent some time also in a residential treatment at Hazelden Betty Ford Center City location, which there I worked with women and the co-occurring substance use and mental health disorders there primarily. Then the last internship that I completed was a residential and outpatient program through Fairview in Chisago City. At that program, I worked with adolescents who specifically were diagnosed with a substance use disorder and co-occurring mental health disorders. In May of 2020, I started working at RCCS, which is a program that focuses on working with men and women. I was specifically in the men's program where we focused on returning citizens from the criminal justice system, and then we focused on substance use and co-occurring mental health as well there. In December of 2020, that is when I started working at Kalina Counseling. I was really excited to start this journey as I really got to work towards my goals of being able to work on the Iron Range. And so I was really excited to start there. And I did online, which was a whole new experience, doing telehealth with clients. And there we focused on substance use disorders, individuals with mental health disorders. And then we're finally in person again. We started to be back in person in June, and that's been an awesome experience.
Well, we, again, are fortunate to have you here within our local community to assist at Kalina Counseling Services and also be part of the broader counseling services within the Lake County and specifically the Two Harbors area. As a professional counselor, Madison, what have been the most prevalent mental health disorders that you have worked with in the past year? And do you believe that those that you've worked with and there is a correlation with COVID-19?
When I started working, especially, I started right in the middle of COVID-19. When I started working, my first job was wearing a mask, and that was a whole new experience in itself. But some of the most prevalent disorders that I have noticed is anxiety, depression, and then also really a spike in some of the substance use disorders, specifically with alcohol and methamphetamine. In terms of the correlation between that and COVID-19, I believe it absolutely has impacted our clients and individuals, because with that, people are feeling so disconnected and isolated in their homes. And then during that time, while feeling isolated, disconnected, there's the ability to increase substance use while at home instead. So, for example, instead of going out and having a couple of drinks with friends, it turned to being at home, buying a bottle of whatever liquor, and then binge drinking liquor at home alone. And that just perpetuated the isolation, the depression, anxiety. And they really, I definitely believe there is a correlation there.
You had mentioned about the depression and anxiety, and that has been a constant theme from the other counselors we've talked to over the past 6 months when we've done the interviews. You had mentioned about the different aspects of what happens because of isolation. With the anxiety and depression, is there also a common denominator where stress comes into that as well?
I think when you start to get stressed, that's when the worry can set in from anxiety, and then the depression of maybe instead of going out and spending time with friends or going out and being with family, you sit at home and start to isolate. And some of those really common symptoms of depression are low motivation, lack of energy, isolation, and kind of feeling helpless. And when you start to feel those things and stay at home, then the COVID on top of that definitely made it more normalized to be at home and do nothing. And then, which again, there's this cycle that just completely perpetuates anxiety and depression because there's that lack of connection, which is so important.
Madison, your bio that I read states that you worked with adolescents and do work with adolescents and adults diagnosed with addiction and co-occurring mental health disorders. For our listeners, can you tell us what exactly are co-occurring mental health disorders?
Co-occurring mental health disorders is basically, commonly people sometimes refer to it as dual diagnoses, which basically means someone's been diagnosed with a substance use disorder and a mental health disorder together. And that's kind of what my main focus was during my time at Hazelden, was how does substance use impact mental health and vice versa? And we've learned that it's helpful to focus on both together, because if one gets, what we see is someone becomes sober from a substance use disorder and then all of a sudden mental health symptoms spike because they don't have coping skills anymore. Substance use is usually a coping skill to cope with maybe some mental health disorder. And when you take that away, then it's that raw, vulnerable place of all this mental health, and then also the mental health that maybe was exacerbated by substance use and the things that come along with substance use. Basically, co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders is working on and identifying the mental health and substance use diagnosis together.
You just mentioned about the duality of co-occurring. So we have substance abuse, we have mental health. Are there any that are usually paired together, meaning a certain type of substance abuse being coexisting with a definitive type of mental health issue that you've seen in your practice?
Yes, there are so many disorders, mental health disorders and substance use disorders that coexist. I could go on and on about all the different ones that kind of play off of each other. One that I've noticed a lot is the depression and alcohol use disorders, because alcohol is a depressant, so that's going to exacerbate the substance use disorder. And then it kind of, again, there's that cycle. Another one that I notice a lot is methamphetamine stimulant use disorder with ADHD. Some people are self-medicating because they have ADHD symptoms, and the meth will calm them down, as would a prescription medication for treating that diagnosis. In terms of what mental health disorder plays off of substance use and vice versa, there's so many, and I think it always will to some degree impact each other. Whether it be self-medicating to help with a mental health disorder or a substance use disorder that then creates or exacerbates a mental health disorder, they definitely have a role in playing together. And it's very rare to find someone who has substance use disorder without co-occurring mental health.
I think that's very important. What you just said is if you have a substance abuse, there's usually a coexisting mental health issue corresponding or adjoining it. You had mentioned two, depression and alcohol, methamphetamine, and ADHD. In your experience, education, and your time here on the North Shore to date, have you seen any specific correlation between the two as far as demographics of male, female, adolescents, teens, anything along that? Or does it just go across the entire spectrum? Or is it more definitive?
It goes across the entire spectrum. That's one thing that I always like to point out and normalize is there's no specific category of people or group that is going to have substance use. In terms of substance use disorders playing a role in different demographic areas, it absolutely goes across the board. It impacts all age, gender, ethnicity. It's everywhere. And that's something that I think helps with normalizing and getting people to understand is it's not the specific age, gender, culture, whatever that is going to be the reason they're diagnosed with a substance use disorder. One of the things that I have noticed in rural places is that substance use disorders do go untreated a lot more often. So then you see a lot of untreated substance use disorders, and then there's less resources. So the treatment, I definitely see that piece being, it's just not as widely available to get treatment for substance use disorders in rural areas. That makes it a little bit of a challenging piece to my own profession, and how do we get these individuals to get the help that they need when the services aren't as readily available as they are as the cities.
One topic that kind of piggybacks on what you were just talking about that is not talked about a lot of times is the counter-reactivity that substance abuse may have with medications that are being used to treat mental health issues and the danger of that. Are you able to address that aspect at all?
Typically, when I do work with people who have substance use disorders, again, we have very limited resources, but I do try to refer them to psychiatrists or behavioral health providers that can prescribe medications that also have knowledge in addiction and substance use, because there's definitely antidepressant medication. It's going to say avoid using alcohol because of the impacts that alcohol is a depressant. So it's going to create some of those symptoms. And then the side effects with medications, your best bet is always to be avoiding alcohol, especially if there's a substance use disorder there. So that's something that I really like to focus on, is trying to refer them to people have kind of education around. Also, on the other end, if you have a substance use disorder and then you get prescribed something that may be addictive, that can create its own addiction in itself. So to have that education and background in substance use disorders while prescribing medications is always something really important to me.
With your experience, and you've been talking about with the mental health disorders co-occurring, can you describe what are some of the common warning signs of substance use behaviors to be aware of? And if you can go through the different age categories, because we tend to sometimes focus on youth, they're really not the only ones who may be having substance abuse issues. So if you could tell us what some of those warning signs would be.
I think substance use and youth, that creates another challenging thing for us as providers, as substance use providers, because with substance use, to diagnose a substance use disorder, we follow a specific criteria. It's 11 criteria that we always go through. And most of that criteria is going to focus on the social, occupational impact that the substance use has on it. For adolescents, they may not have those consequences yet. They may not have the daily functioning consequences that you would see maybe in an adult or an older adult. Even like physical health, that with kids and adolescents, they're not going to have those consequences yet, as opposed to someone who is an older adult who maybe is having liver functioning is being impacted by use and things like that. Some of the warning signs are the signs and symptoms of substance use disorders that we really as licensed LABCs focus on is several criteria. So some of those criteria include, are you often using substances in larger amounts over longer periods of time than was originally intended? So are you going out and saying, I'm going to have two drinks tonight with my friends, and then you end up having 10 to 15 drinks with your friend? The other criteria is spending a significant amount of time obtaining, using, or recovering from the effects of a substance. This can be obtaining a substance if it's some sort of illicit drug or something like that. They're going to have to take time to go get that drug wherever they find it. And then there's also using it, that there's a whole ritual that goes along with that. Is that taking time? And then recovering from the effects. I think this is something that you're going to go through some withdrawals if you have a substance use disorder. Are you hungover the next day, having a hard time getting to work, feeling really in the moment, in the present moment, because you're hungover or going through withdrawal from substances? Another criteria is having unsuccessful efforts to quit or cut down use. Is it really hard? Are you saying, oh, I'm never going to drink again, I'm never going to use again, and then the next day you find yourself drinking and using again? A lot of times people will, in terms of alcohol use, they'll try to switch out from, hey, I'm drinking beer, maybe if I switch to hard liquor, that will do the trick. I'll not drink as much with hard liquor. And then they find themselves really confused because they still have those unsuccessful efforts to cut down their use. Another criteria is impacting work, relationships with family and friends. This is a big one, and this is what we always focus on when anyone comes into treatment for substance use disorders. Substance use disorders is a family disease. It will impact all areas of the family. It will impact friendships. There's the consequences that come from substance use that really impact our ability to be with friends and have really positive connections. What's kind of interesting with that as well is that's what perpetuates the cycle of going into maybe some of the mental health disorders or using again, because that support's gone when they become sober. And when the support's gone, that's when you start to see the returning to use because they don't have that support. Another warning sign is it impacting your physical or mental health, and are you using despite that? Are you going in to the doctor and they say, hey, your liver enzymes are elevated or something's happening in your body and you're still using whatever that substance is, despite the fact that you know it's probably impacting your physical health? And then it's also the mental health. Is it impacting your ability to, is it making or exacerbating depressive symptoms? Are you noticing you're less motivated when you're coming off of your drug? Are you noticing that things around your mental health are just getting exacerbated by either withdrawal or while intoxicated? The next one is cravings. And this is an interesting topic because with our adolescents specifically, cravings is something that happens in the brain. It's your brain telling you you need, and it's sending a signal saying, hey, I need this drug that I'm dependent on. You need this to survive. And with adolescents, you don't usually see that because they don't have as much time using. So the cravings are something that happens in the brain, and this is something you see in adults and older adults more than you would see in adolescents. Same with tolerance. Tolerance is defined as using more to get a desired effect. Is your tolerance, are you drinking, instead of the three drinks, you have to drink five to get that same effect? And is it going up and up? The last two that we focus on is withdrawal. So withdrawal can be an array of different symptoms depending on what substances it is that you're using. So are you shaking in the morning? Are you having anxiety? We even talk about post-acute withdrawal syndrome, which is also effects from substances that can last up to 6 months, 1 year, 2 years. And the post-acute withdrawal, specifically with meth, can be, you're not going to feel good mentally for about a year if your use is really severe, because the dopamine, the serotonin, that has all been depleted. So then you start to notice this kind of feeling of being unhappy, and that happens a lot, we see with meth use. The last kind of warning sign or thing that you can, if you start to notice, is using in situations that might be physically hazardous. Or are you driving while you're intoxicated? That's a physically hazardous thing that especially I notice up in rural towns where there isn't as much availability to taxis. So a lot of people are like, oh, okay, well, I'll just drive because we're in the country. That's another area that you look for. Are you making those decisions, or maybe not even making those decisions, but are you driving while you're intoxicated due to just not having the ability to get a safe ride home? Or are you doing it just because it's more convenient?
Madison, you let off the segment here talking about a focus on work and family, and you just led us through a very detailed analysis of what it's like for the individual. Can you kind of flip over to the other side? And for those who may be coworkers or family members, what would be warning signs that one of their coworkers or a family member may have a substance abuse issue?
For family members and coworkers, you're probably going to start to notice a change in behavior. I think that's probably one of the biggest signs, is something is different with their behavior. Maybe they're not showing up to work when they usually are always on time. Maybe they're coming in later and later and later, and they're usually always on time. That's for work. And then for family members, maybe not attending social gatherings or family events when they previously used to. It can also be a change in just mood, just, you know, noticing lower motivation, lower overall mood and ability to make it to some of these important things in their life that they once were able to do. I think with family and coworkers, it's always important to ask, but also know that with a brain disease of addiction, that there's going to sometimes be that piece of they're not even there yet to admit it to themselves. And so to kind of come to those individuals asking with an empathetic stance of, or non-judgmental stance of, just out of care and compassion, if that makes sense.
It does. One of the primary goals and focus for mental health providers is to address the stigma that's associated with mental health, getting people to talk about it, to tell what they're experiencing, to ask for help, to get assessed. You have just brought in another entire perspective with the substance abuse, which is coexistent with mental health. Can you talk about, again, addressing the stigma and the shame that occurs with this?
The shame piece is so prevalent in substance use disorders and mental health. This is something that I've noticed in, you know, my own experience and also professional experience being in rural areas specifically, because there's a lot of people talk. Everybody knows everything in these small towns. So people kind of retreat and don't want to go get services because there's that shame, there's stigma that, oh, you're asking for help, you need help, you're weak. Those kind of, there's these messages that you see in smaller communities and larger ones, but I've definitely noticed it in the smaller communities, that stigma of, if you have a mental health disorder, if you have a substance use disorder, you're weak. Your will is not there. Like, what are you doing? You're messing, you know, all these narratives and ideas that kind of go around a community. And when you're in a small community, then there's that fear of, is this going to be anonymous? Am I going to have a confidential person where I can speak to and without someone seeing me going in? With stigma and the shame piece, I think one of the really important pieces with substance use is normalizing that idea that everybody can be impacted by substance use. I don't know that I've ever met with a single client when I say, hey, is there substance use within your family, that they say no. At least 99% of the time, there's someone in their life, or if not themselves, that has dealt with substance use disorders. It's everywhere. And to normalize that, that's okay to get help, and it's okay to really work on these things. Another area is the recurrence of use, or returning to use. Kind of focusing on normalizing that as well, because there's, when someone is trying to be sober and they can't get sober, and one of those warning signs or criteria is the idea of trying to cut down and you're having these unsuccessful efforts. When we kind of normalize that, it's sometimes you are going to return to use. Sometimes there may be a reoccurrence. It doesn't have to be, but it's okay if you do. That decreases the shame. And when you can kind of normalize that and decrease shame, then people are going to be more likely to get help. If they feel really guilty and there's a lot of shame involving substance use or mental health, the likelihood of getting help definitely decreases. About 10% of people with substance use disorders actually get professional services that they need. And this is a big piece of, because the stigma perpetuates the shame and it impacts people reaching out for help. So I think sometimes really looking at what can you do as a community, decrease that stigma. If someone says so-and-so is dealing with this mental health disorder, just kind of trying to normalize that and advocate for those people who have substance use disorders and advocate for those people who have mental health disorders and normalize it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to reach out for help. I truthfully feel reaching out for help shows so much courage and strength. I really try every day to advocate for those individuals and express how much strength and courage it takes to get the help that you need and to be vulnerable with someone who is a stranger. And there's so much strength and courage in that. And I just hope other people can really try to focus on reducing that stigma and shame.
Well, I believe you pretty well just may have answered my next question, which would have been, as a practitioner, what are your recommendations for anyone who believes they may need mental health services or help with substance abuse but are unsure? I think you cover that pretty well. And there's the other side, which is if you know somebody, a friend, a neighbor, a family member, how would you advise them if they're unsure of what to do if they believe the person may need services?
That's always a challenging thing when you see people who are really struggling in your life that are having challenges with these things. It's really a hard topic to reach out to other people, you know, say, hey, I think you need help. I think something that I always try to express to the individuals that come to my office and to clients and people is to avoid kind of the advice giving of you need to do this versus saying, I've been noticing. Coming from a place of compassion and empathy and saying, hey, I'm worried about you. I've noticed these symptoms or these signs. And do you think you want me to help you with scheduling an appointment or something like that? But always coming from that non-judgmental or empathetic stance instead of going in and saying, you need help or I'm going to do this and giving ultimatums. Because I don't know about everyone, and I'm not speaking for everyone, but for myself, if someone comes up and says, you need to do this, I kind of have a defiant piece in me that's like, nope, now I'm going to show you I can do it on my own. So to really come from a place of compassion and wanting to help versus making it as a ultimatum or something like that is what I would recommend for people wanting to reach out to individuals that they feel need services.
Madison, all providers or work in an agency such as you do with Kalina Counseling Services have limitations either by our education or licensure experience. And at Kalina Counseling Services, can you tell us what the protocols are for identified mental health issues where the services needed are not offered at your location? What do you do then with that patient or client?
As a therapist, as you probably know too, we're helpers. We want to help everyone. And sometimes there are those limitations. And to help is to recognize this is something that is outside of my scope. This is something that needs a different person, a different professional with that area of expertise. What we always can do is refer out and provide any recommendations for individuals that might need a different service that's provided. Again, we're limited in rural areas, but we do our best to always, if we'll look, and with the telehealth services and has really opened some doors for people who do need specific areas of expertise, the telehealth has been so helpful because they can do these online sessions. That's been really a good thing that I really appreciate is the online telehealth services. So we always can refer out. And I think just getting your foot through the door and having that courage and having that strength to say you need help is always going to be the first step. And then if it's something outside that's not offered at our location, we're going to refer and help provide recommendations to get you whatever it is that you need.
I want to remind our listeners today that we have been speaking with Madison Witchen, who is a mental health therapist with the Kalina Counseling Services here in Two Harbors. Madison, we want to thank you for being with us today. and wish you the very best.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.